Hello again, podcasters, and welcome again to this series of podcasts brought to you in association with Kilkenny Library Services and the Government's Decade of Centenaries Fund through Kilkenny County Council. My name is Owen Swinton Welsh, and these podcasts we examine different aspects of Kilkenny's revolutionary era history. Now, recently we talked about some of the big house burnings in Kilkenny. That is the setting of property on fire on purpose for political motivations. The history books of this period usually focus on the nearly 300 big houses that were burnt. However, there were also an array of what we'll call small house burnings during the revolutionary period that often don't get the same mention. These were usually smaller family homes that were targeted. The Crown Forces, usually the Black and Tans or auxiliary section of the Crown Forces, were prone to setting a light to thatch on farmhouses at homes of suspected IRA sympathisers. Now, when we move into the Civil War, both sides used the same kind of tactic, often in a tit-for-tat reprisal and counter-reprisal nature. The Free State Forces burnt houses of suspected anti-treatyites or their harbourers or supporters, while the anti-treaty would attack homes of vocal Free State supporters or local politicians. These burnings reached their zenith in the spring of 1923 at the very tail end of the Civil War. Now, if we just think of the practicalities of these burnings just for a second, specifically in March and April 1923, where are we at? The anti-treaty IRA were at the very low ebb at this time. Many of their most active fighters had been captured and interned. One way the remaining anti-treaty IRA pockets around the county could continue to fight was the destruction of property, to try and bankrupt the new Free State being the ultimate aim. Burning homes in the middle of the night also greatly reduced the chance of getting caught or arrested. So for the remaining groups of anti-treaty fighters, this was one impactful way of continuing their struggle without the risk of being arrested. It also required little or no ammunition, if you don't include petrol, of course, so they weren't wasting that either, and ammo, of course, was in short supply for them at this stage. Now, the Free State side fought this fire with their own fire, so to speak, but they were in a trickier situation. They were meant to be the official state army, above all these dirty tactics, yet they were participating in arson. The idea of reprisal or tit-for-tat warfare was an element of the War of Independence fight against the British, as we talked about. The Civil War then continued on similar lines, but this grey area does explain why the Free State soldiers would usually, if not always, be dressed in civilian clothes when they were doing their fire setting, so not in the uniform of the Army of the Irish Free State. We don't know how far up the echelons of power in the Free State the approval went for this type of warfare, but as house burning was a tactic used around Ireland and not just in Kilkenny, we can assume it was approved to some extent on high. It was probably left to the local leadership to decide their own course of action in any area, with perhaps a nod with the implication, sure, do what you have to do, so to speak. And the dogs in the street kind of knew it was the Free State Army setting fire to these anti-treaty houses, if we can call them that. But the newspapers didn't or even weren't permitted to write that down. Now, this Free State tactic probably did work to an extent. It was an eye for an eye, and eventually someone has to go blind. And the burnings petered out fairly quickly. The destruction of small family homes in the spring of 1923 was probably just an illustration of how bad the Civil War had got as things went on. If we think for a second of the war's trajectory, the start of the Civil War in the summer of 1922 witnessed what some would term proper fighting. That is kind of big set piece battles, man on man stuff, what would be considered honourable or gentlemanly fighting, if I can use those terms in that context. But then it quickly slipped into guerrilla fighting into the awesome, less gentlemanly stuff. Then with the introduction of the Free State execution policy of anti-treaty prisoners, it took another nasty turn, which in turn led to the rise of ad hoc executions by both sides. This then led on to big house burnings to target the wealthy supporters of the Irish Free State. which in turn then led to small house burnings by the spring of 1923. In terms of arson as an element of the Civil War, if we look at the start of the fighting, the arson was mainly targeted at the railway network. Stations around the country were destroyed by the Anti-Treaty to disrupt the new free state. These railway lines and stations were owned by large railway conglomerates, so their destruction was probably easier for them to do in moralistic terms. Besides the obvious massive inconvenience to the public, it wasn't a direct attack on someone's home. However, like everything with civil war and probably war generally, by the end, there were no rules. Family homes were now a target. They were quite literally in the firing line, if you excuse the pun there. And I probably should say before we go any further that as we talk about these burnings in kind of clinical historical terms, we shouldn't forget about the trauma a house burning could cause to a family, and not just in terms of the practicalities of becoming homeless. The people in these houses were often the female family members of participants of the Civil War. So that includes family of the IRA, family of Free State soldiers or Cumann na mBan women, or even perhaps the families of politicians. Often too, they were children in these houses. Some occupants of targeted homes could have been the elderly parents of Civil War participants too, literally three or four generations in a household. So to have masked men coming in, ordering you out in the dead of the night, and then setting your home on fire in front of your eyes was not something you are likely to forget in a hurry. Some of these family members may not have been involved in the fighting in any way, shape or form. In other words, they were innocent and also may not have been used to such aggression. But now they were very much thrust onto the front line. Civil war had literally come to their door. To some of those inflicting this punishment, it was seen as a lighter penalty by some because the people in question were not physically harmed, unlike some of their comrades, we'll say, who may have been killed. It was just the home that was being destroyed. It could have been a lot worse in some people's eyes. Now, this leads us to our grim examples of these tactics in South Kilkenny during the spring of 1923. Between big and small houses, in a 6-week period between the end of February and early April 1923, 7 homes were destroyed in Kilkenny. We've already talked about the big houses that were burnt at the end of February, namely Dysart and Besborough House. But just a few weeks after that, 2 smaller homes were destroyed in Kilmana. The home of the Tehan family, known as Shipton or Sheepstown House, was burnt down on the night of the 20th of March 1923 by Free State soldiers. The following night, a home on the grocery business nearby, the Minogues, was also set alight by Free State soldiers. The Tehan home at Shipton had been a pivotal location for the IRA during the War of Independence and then during the Civil War. Their good friends, the Minogues, headed by Richard Minogue, often helped them out with this work, putting up visitors for the night and especially with providing food supplies. On the night in question, that being the 20th of March 23, Bridget Tehan and her family were given 5 minutes to leave before the house was set alight by Free State soldiers. Bridget was mother of 12 children who farmed 125 acres. She was also a widow at this stage of her life. Her husband had been deceased for a few years. The family also ran another farm at Barrack Hill. Some of Bridget's sons were members of the Anti-Treaty IRA and her daughters were leading members of Cumann na mBan in the area. One of Bridget Tehan's sons, Richard Tehan, was actually at this time of the burning incarcerated in Kilkenny jail, having been caught at an ambush in Kilmana a few weeks beforehand. The Tehan home was a hub really for resting IRA men on the run. Bill Quirk, who was officer commanding of the 2nd Southern Division Anti-Treaty IRA, defined Shipton as thus, quote, "The Tehan home at Shipton might be described as a field GHQ, that's General Headquarters, for a considerable period until it was eventually burned down by the very men it often sheltered during the War of Independence," he means, end quote. Shipton House was also used by Kilkenny City coming to Mon as a transport point to deliver dispatches and ammunition for onward distribution to the West Kilkenny battalions. Mary, or Molly Tehan, later Foley, daughter of Bridget, described what happened the night prior to the burning. It was evident that the Free State forces were watching their house or had been tipped off in some way. Quote, President Eamon de Valera called during the night with Frank Aiken, Austin Stack, Shawnee Dowling, Tom Darrig and Shawnee Hyde. There was no man to help them out. All the local men were on the run, and were it not for our help, the whole crowd could have been captured in a strange countryside. I got safe conduct for them to Tipperary, and that night scarcely had the company even gone when the house was raided and burned by armed and masked men. End quote. So for helping De Valera and Frank Aiken out, the Minogues and the Tehans paid a big price. Now, it could have been accumulation of things here. The Free State would have also been aware that the IRA that burnt down Dysart Court a few weeks previously would likely have met in and around Shipton at some stage. Dysart Court was only 4 miles away. And perhaps, not such a coincidence, the home of Dr. Daniel Byrne, who was a Farmers Party TD and lived at the islands in Mulnahone, was burnt out just 2 nights before the Shipton burning. So tensions must have been really high in the Free State at this point, and De Valera's arrival in the area would really have annoyed them further. From the Free State perspective, it was probably the final straw. De Valera himself would have known the Tehans, having previously visited the house in August 1922, some months before, in the early days of the Civil War. So he and his party would have trusted them as reliable and very trustworthy people to help find a way around the countryside. Now, the 20th of March date here that all this happened is also important. The men mentioned by Molly Tehan, who she had helped convey through the area, were basically half the anti-Treaty IRA leadership in Ireland at the time. And of course, De Valera was the political leader of the movement. The Republican leadership were on their way for a meeting in County Tipperary fixed for a few days later. The anti-Treaty IRA leadership were meeting to discuss ending the Civil War, and it nearly did, on a vote of 6 votes for continuing the fighting, 5 votes against the fighting. The leader, Liam Lynch, wanted to keep going on, and of course it would take another 2 months before it properly finished. Now, at this time, the Tehans were renting Shipton House, which wouldn't have been unusual as it was just a few decades after the Land Acts and the various tenant purchase schemes. The owner of the house was actually J.J. Long of Limerick. Now, this was a time when there was no house insurance as we would understand it today. Instead, because of the political upheaval, there was a state-funded compensation scheme, because it was kind of a political conflict that destroyed most of these houses. Altogether, the landlord and Mrs. Bridget Tehan received £2,865 in compensation for the rebuilding of the house and the loss of property. Now, altogether, that's around €250,000 in today's money. But Bridget Tehan's part of that application was challenged in a high-profile court case as the state, via Kilkenny County Council, tried to block Bridget's application outright. They said that as she was a Republican sympathiser who aided the IRA, she was not entitled to claim any compensation as per the terms of the law. The judge, however, found in Miss Tehan's favour. The 54-year-old Bridget Tehan had to go on the stand herself and defend the claim. In his final summation, the judge said that the prosecution, who were trying to stop Mrs. Tehan getting money, which had included as a witness the Free State Commandant of Kilkenny, James O'Hanrahan, brought no evidence to show how Mrs. Tehan or her family were sympathetic or active members of the anti-treaty cause. Having visitors at the house, including Eamon de Valera, was not enough evidence to say that Bridget Tehan, AL, were all actively helping the Republican cause. The judge pointed out that over the years, De Valera had visited many, many houses, including the homes of aristocracy. They all couldn't be active Republicans. Similarly, the fact that Bridget's daughters visited the IRA prisoners in jail did not prove they or any of the Tehans were actively aiding the Republicans. The only one who was proven to be a Republican, the judge said, was Richard Tehan, who had been arrested at an ambush. The total sum paid to Mrs. Tien was reduced by £66 on account of her son Richard being an IRA man. This would have been his share as one of the 12 children who had lived in the house. £100 of Bridget Tien's total was the amount given for the loss of hay in the fire, and £150 was given to reinstate the hay barn. £924 was paid to Bridget Tien for the loss of furniture and clothes inside the house, which the Tiehans had mostly bought for themselves. So in total she received close to £1,200, or about €105,000 in today's money. In his judgment as to the type of house Shipton was and how much it would cost to reinstate it, the judge said, quote, "This mansion has been described as of a Georgian type, but apparently it was not Georgian, it was only 80 or 90 years old. I think that what I ought to aim at is a sum that would restore that house so as to be a proper residence for the farmers that are using it. Mrs. Tehan and family, I do not think, would be likely to build a Georgian mansion, and in the position in which they live, they do not want more than a farmer's residence," end quote. So, although not exactly a fortune by any standards, the money received by the Tehans would barely cover their lost property in hay, but it could have been a lot worse for them if the application had been voided outright. The landlord, J.J. Long, would have got his share with a reinstatement order, which meant the house had to be rebuilt from the funds. And it was rebuilt, and newer generations of Tehans still live there in the house today. Now, less than 2 weeks after the Shipton burning, and in a likely retaliation for that attack, the anti-treaty IRA set fire to a dwelling house, grocery and bakery in Templeorum, Piltown, at midnight on Easter Monday night, the bank holiday, the 2nd of April 1923. The business in question was owned by James Welch, who was a pro-treaty Kilkenny County Councillor. He also ran a grocery and pub in Ballyhale. Although his Templeorum premises were over 30 miles from Shipton House in Kilmana, Welch was likely targeted as he had been very vocal in his denunciations of the actions of the anti-treaty IRA, both locally and during his contributions to county council meetings. Indeed, just a few months previously, in October 1922, he had been taken prisoner for one day by Richard Brennan's South Kilkenny Flying Column as a warning to tone down his denunciations of the IRA. He was also taken away by the anti-treaty when they controlled his home district in July 1922. Then in December 1922, Welch's motor van he used for his business was stopped and taken in Ballymountain near Munkine by a party of anti-treaty IRA under the command of Pat Welch of Clogha, no relation to James. James' son Patrick was driving that van at the time, and he was held up for a number of hours. The cigarettes and sugar inside were also taken. The van was found a week later, but very badly damaged, in Ballinaboli Woods in Kilmacow. A horse-drawn van was also burnt out 2 months even before that, in October 1922. But all of this did not seem to have the desired effect on James Welch. He was not intimidated. Therefore, as he was very much the anti-treaty IRA's wet new war in this part of South Kilkenny, they were probably only looking for an excuse to hit back at him. And it's also possible that some of the anti-treaty IRA in South Kilkenny would have been aware of the Tehan's contribution to the cause over the previous years. And some may even have had meetings or met up or stayed at Shipton. So in many ways, attacking the business and home of James Welch was killing two birds with one stone. For his compensation claim, everything that was destroyed or taken from the shop, pub and bakery business had to be itemised. It also included items, his compensation claim included items that went back to mid-July 1922, when the anti-treaty IRA took over the parish of Templeorum in Piltown. That was the lead up to the Battle of Carrick. His business was raided for provisions at that time too. So for instance, James claimed 15 shillings for the loss of 9 pounds of butter, 12 shillings for the loss of a dozen pair of socks, 1 pound and 7 shillings for the loss of cigarettes, 3 pounds for the loss of 130 pounds of sugar, and 12 pounds for the loss of a bicycle. And also it shows what the IRA needed at the time. £2.10 was claimed for the loss of 20 pairs of men's underwear, or drawers as they were called at the time. The contents of his burnt down home was also included in the total figure. It included six mahogany chairs valued at £12, a violin and case valued at £4, and suits belonging to himself and his son valued at £20. Now, the compensation claims could drag on for a few years, so prior to his compensation being paid out for his premises, Welch wrote of his frustration at the long drawn out process, but he also gave a window into his life during the Civil War years. Writing this in April 1925, he said, quote, "I had to erect early in 1923, after the fire, a stopgap wood and felt store on site. Indispensable protection for trade stock. Bear in mind, this is a backward country district where one cannot rush work as in a town, and immediate storage accommodation is so vital. Having 11 children to educate and support, the withholding of such a large amount over a long period is a crushing financial handicap to me. To support the treaty, I faced a crusade of trade boycotting, loosing, kidnapping, and acute danger of assassination with bulldog courage," end quote. James Welch eventually received a total of £4,173 in compensation, around €370,000 in today's money, and that was paid out in September 1926 for the rebuilding, basically, of his home and business. £1,776 of the total, that's a little under half, was for the cost of the building work itself and rebuilding the house. The rest was mostly stock and furniture that was lost. Now, the next house burning occurred just 2 nights after the business of James Welch was destroyed on Easter Monday night, and this was no coincidence. This time it was the family home of a local IRA leader that was set alight by Free State forces in a reprisal for the attack on James Welch's house. As we said previously, often it was the women of a family who suffered the brunt of arson attacks, as the male members would be on the run. 55-year-old widow Mary Welch of Portnascolly Mill in Carrageen, Munkine, County Kilkenny, was one such person. Her son, Jack Nicola, or Jack Nicola Welch, was leader of the 9th Battalion Anti-Treaty IRA based in Munkine, County Kilkenny. His jurisdiction took in Kilmacow, Slievrew, and of course Munkine in South Kilkenny, but also stretched into Templeorman and Piltown during the latter stages of the Civil War. He was not there on the night in question, as he could not stay in the house for months for fear of arrest, so Mary Welch and her family were awoken by non-uniformed Free State soldiers during the early hours of the 4th of April 1923. She described what occurred in her own words. Quote, "Nine men, all armed with rifles and revolvers and carrying petrol tins, entered the yard. I was in bed. I saw the men pumping petrol on the outhouses, and I got up and went to the bedroom window. One of the men told me to get up at once and open the door. I refused. He drove in the window. My daughter came down and opened the door for him. One of the men rushed in and ordered us all out. We dressed and went out. The men then sprinkled petrol on the chairs and on the tables and on the children's bed. We went out into the yard and let out the cattle out into the field. The dwelling house was then set on fire. Bombs or grenades must have been used, as the walls shattered," end quote. Along with the house, which had five bedrooms and outhouses, 5 tons of very valuable hay and 5 tons of mangoles, which were kind of a winter feed for livestock, and 8 tons of straw were also destroyed in the arson attack. Later on, Mary Welch applied to the Free State government for compensation for the destruction of her home. The Free State authorities, though, tried to block her claim outright because of the anti-treaty IRA activity of her sons and daughters. Mary Welch, however, won her claim in the local court, but the state then appealed this decision and her claim went all the way to the High Court. This 55-year-old widow and mother of 10 children was then called into the witness box to defend herself for a woman who had lived a tough life, who was now in very unfamiliar surroundings. She showed she was definitely not intimidated, not in the slightest. She gave an absolute masterclass in deflection and obfuscation, never getting caught out or digging herself into a hole, although there was a few traps set out for her. She said enough not to damage her claim for compensation in any way, but also did not insult the principles of her children and the Republican path they had chosen. Here are just some examples of the exchanges in the High Court. Firstly, with her own representation. Quote, "You were raided frequently, Mrs. Welch." "Yes." "Were you raided by people to whom you had given shelter in the black and tan time?" "Yes, it would annoy anyone." "There was never anything discovered, though, on any occasion when you were raided." "Never anything." "It was suggested that you were not polite to them. Is that correct?" "I resented them for turning the place upside down." End quote. And now here are some exchanges between Mary Welch and the opposing barrister when she was in the witness box still. Quote, "Were you taking sides, Mrs. Welch?" Mary Welch replied, "I never took sides." "You never took sides with the Free State or Republicans?" "No, I never meddled about politics in any shape or form." "Do you remember the morning which Commandant Hanrahan of the Free State Army said that firing was going on in a field near your house?" "Yes, but he is under a false impression. My son was not in the house at all." "And that he saw a man running from the house?" "There was no man in the house. He might be near us, but he was not in the house." "Who slept in the house then?" "Just the girls and myself." "So he," this Commandant Hanrahan, "told an untruth when he said your son was in the house that day?" "He was not in the house. I remember that distinctly." "Your two sons, John," that's Jack Nicola, "and Edward," Ned Nicola, "were opposed to the Free State government." "John was opposed, but I can't think whether Edward was." "How often used they called to your house?" "Ah, very seldom, once every 3 months." "Did you approve of what they are doing?" "How do you mean, approve of us?" "Did you think that they were on the right side?" "I didn't interfere with them in any way at all, but asked them to help out on the farm and they said they could not." "You could not interfere with them? They are well beyond the age of that." "I may take it then here publicly that you disclaim all connection with the irregular policy, that is the anti-treaty policy." "Oh well, that is a big question. Would it be an exaggeration to say that your house was the headquarters of the irregulars in South Kilkenny?"
Mary Welch replied.
"Could you prove it?" "Well, would it be the second most important house in Kilkenny then?" "It would during the black and tan time, but not during the irregular time." "Did you ever give assistance to the officers when they were searching your house?" "Why should I assist them? They turned the house upside down." "Do you think that your sons were on the right side?" "I had no opinion of us at all." "But I ask you again, did you think they were on the right or the wrong side?" "If every person's thoughts were known, it would be a very different world." "Are you refusing to answer the question? Did you think the boys were on the right side or the wrong side?" "I didn't know what to think." "You told us already. You approved of their policy." "I did not." "I have it here in the notes of your evidence previously given. I ask you, did you approve of us in your own mind? And your answer is, well, I may have." Mary Welch then replied, "I have enough to do to answer to God without answering to the government for the things going on in my mind." End quote. Now, in another lifetime, Mary Welch could definitely have been in the field of law. Certainly, if she was around today, she might have had the opportunities. And the High Court did actually find in her favour, and Mary Welch's compensation claim went through to rebuild her home. The total awarded was £1,387 to rebuild her home at Portinscolly Mill, which is approximately €115,000 in today's money. It was by no means a large amount and probably would barely cover the expense of it all, but it was better than the alternative of £0, which would have been the case if the appeal by Kilkenny County Council vis-a-vis the Free State Government had won out. Now, another property was destroyed in South Kilkenny during these weeks, although we are not sure if it's related in any way to the other events. But it is likely that this burning was at least another reason for the Free State Army to attack the home of Jack Nicola Welsh of Portnascully Mill that we just talked about, which was located just a few miles away from this house. The sheds and farm machinery owned by a lady called Maria Mackey from Granny Kilmacow, just over the border from Munkine, was destroyed in the early hours of St. Patrick's Day, 17th of March 1923. People will know Granny Castle on the road, the main road between Waterford and Limerick. Her house was located close to there. Mackey was accused of giving information to the Free State forces against the local anti-Treaty IRA. But although her actual home wasn't destroyed, just her outbuildings, her cat though was also assassinated by the anti-Treaty IRA men. The dead cat was tied to the gate in the entrance to her house with a message affixed to its body saying, "Convicted spy, beware. The same penalty will be laid out to the owners of the cat if found out giving any information. Signed, the IRA." This was an unusual occurrence to kill a pet like that, although the IRA probably thought it more lenient than burning the actual house down or hurting Maria herself. Although the poor Cass probably wouldn't think that. Maria Mackey was later awarded £60 by the Free State government for the destruction of her property, not including the Cass, although she had requested double that, nearly £118. She had estimated her three burnt down cow sheds to have been worth at least £80 alone. So in today's money, she received just over €5,000, although she'd actually requested €10,000. To finish up and summarize, the examples highlighted here in this podcast highlighted the reprisal and counter-reprisal nature of the Civil War in just a 6 week window in Kilkenny, showing the no holds barred nature that the Civil War had morphed into. All the houses we mentioned that were destroyed by fire were later rebuilt. This doesn't take account, of course, of the trauma of seeing your home or business being destroyed or burnt down. The near bankrupt Free State government later paid out compensation money to the victims of these house burnings. In other words, it was the Irish taxpayer who eventually had to stump up in the end. The more things changed, the more they say the same, plus a change, as the saying used to go. It is just another example, if one was needed, of the futility of civil war. And I think that's where we leave it today. Just to thank you all once again for listening. And don't forget to join your local library to avail of all the brilliant free resources. Until next time.